It's a great pleasure for me to be here, and I'd like to thank the organizers of this function for inviting me to come and share a few thoughts with you. I am going to be speaking about socioeconomic rights, which is a difficult subject. I should tell you that my court, the Constitutional Court, started dealing with socioeconomic rights from inception, that is, when we first started hearing cases in 1995, beginning of 1995. The court was constituted in 1994, but we only started working, doing our core function in 1995. And socioeconomic rights are featured largely in the matters that we have been dealing with. Now, I say it's a difficult subject because it's an area which lends itself to debates, disagreements, and so on and so forth. The first disagreement emerged when the discussion was about whether socioeconomic rights should be included in the Constitution. There were those who felt that they should not be included in the Constitution at all. But our founding mothers and fathers in South Africa and sisters and brothers saw fit to include socioeconomic rights in our Constitution, and there it is. But the work of the Constitutional Court has diverted largely to that, because we are a nation with vast disparities between the poor and the rich, the wealth, and those who are actually wanting a lot of assistance. Therefore, we find ourselves having to deal with socioeconomic rights almost on a day-to-day basis as a court. Constitutional Court judges have researchers, law clerks, and one of my law clerks, ex-law clerk, spent about 2 years with me at the Constitutional Court, and then he decided to go to a very famous university called Oxford University and spend some time here doing his PhD. When he came back, and I think this was possibly one of his activities as a student, he wrote a book about socioeconomic rights. Now, obviously, it was a brilliant book. This was a brilliant young man, is a brilliant young man. And he disagreed with a number of things we had been saying in the Constitutional Courts on socioeconomic rights. I mention that because although he wrote this wonderful book disagreeing with a few aspects, he then comes to me, says, "Chief Justice, I've been your clerk for a long time, and I'm sure you did very good work. So will you write a foreword for me for this book?" I looked at the book. I saw the areas where he disagreed with us, and I wondered whether I should write a foreword. Anyway, I ended up writing the foreword and saying this is a brilliant book, even though I disagree with it in a number of respects. But as I say, it's a great pleasure to be here. I hope that what I have to say will trigger a healthy exchange of views over the next 2 days about what is undoubtedly an important topic. The workshop will address two themes: the role of courts in defining the social contract and the case study of socioeconomic rights. I shall focus largely on the latter theme, but I intend to do so in the light of what may be called South Africa's social contract of transformative constitutionalism. I hope that the South African perspective may shed new light on some old debates and will be of interest to jurists in developed and developing nations alike. Let me begin, however, by considering briefly the idea of a social contract and its relationship with courts. The relevant branch of social contract theory, as I understand it, is a theory about the legitimacy of political authority. It claims that legitimate government authority must derive from the consent of the governed, where that consent takes the form of an agreement of sorts. The terms of the agreement represent the basic arrangements of society, which may encompass notions of distributive and commutative justice, fundamental rights and obligations of state and citizens, and the like. As a historical claim, social contract theory is perhaps untrue in many contexts, simply because the current citizens of most states have never concluded a genuine contract in the past. Recent strands of social contractorization have therefore taken a turn towards the hypothetical. In this form, social contract theory asks, would such and such fundamental right be agreed upon by citizens in conditions of equal bargaining power and knowledge, fairness, and impartiality? If the answer is yes, so the theory goes, then that fundamental right imposes genuine duties on others, and its enforcement and protection by the state is legitimate. When we consider the role of courts in defining the social contract, however, we are immediately struck by a tension. Why, given that the content of the social contract is supposed ideally to be based on the people's assent, why should elite and esoteric courts play any role whatsoever in defining it? This objection, however, seems to me misplaced. As a judge, the notions of real and hypothetical consent of the people strike me as useful, particularly when courts address basic questions of justice, such as those relating to socioeconomic rights. Many human rights disputes throw up intractable conflicts that cannot be resolved by mere reference to the relevant legal text. In such cases, result must be heard to the values underlying the legal system. When doing so, I think that judges may usefully ask themselves, is this what our people in fact have agreed to? Is this what our people would ideally have agreed to? In particular, judges should give great weight to the actual and hypothetical views of those who, in reality, have little bargaining power and almost no say in society, and I mean the poor. Socioeconomic imbalances in a political community are very likely, over time, to skew social arrangements to favor those in positions of relative privilege and power. If that is the case, as it certainly is in South Africa, judges should approach human rights adjudication so as to uplift the underprivileged and thereby to reorientate the social contract in a way that is fair to all. There is a clear parallel, moreover, between the idea of inequality of bargaining power in concluding a social contract and real-world inequalities of voice and participation in the democratic process. Thus, the role of the courts in deciding fundamental rights cases should, I think, be aimed at the protection and promotion of deliberative democracy, that ideal of self-governance, participation, and public justification of the exercise of political authority. Furthermore, it is obvious that in many societies, these inequalities flow predominantly from disparities in access to education, social security, healthcare services, adequate housing, and sufficient food and water. It is incumbent, therefore, on judges to take these discrepancies into account and to settle disputes in a way that alleviates them to the extent legally permissible in their jurisdictions. I mentioned at the outset the idea of what I call South Africa's social contract of transformative constitutionalism. This has two aspects. The first is that our constitution approximates, albeit imperfectly, the ideal of an actual historical social contract of people of South Africa, at least to the current generation. The Constitutional Assembly, the elected body responsible for the drafting and adoption of the final constitution, took public participation to a new level. A host of public meetings and workshops were held around the country. It received over 2 million submissions from private individuals and organizations before the first draft was circulated for public comment. The unprecedented scale of participation is evidence that our constitutional settlement is expressed in terms that many South Africans embrace. The second aspect is that our constitution is fundamentally transformative. This has been expressly recognized by the Constitutional Court and other courts. A previous Chief Justice has written that, and I quote, "Commitment to transform our society lies at the heart of the new constitutional order," unquote. I too have advanced some thoughts on this spirit of transformation, and it is now appropriate to revisit those ideas. I believe that the core idea is we must change. The goal of our constitution is to heal the wounds of the past and guide us to a better future. The epilogue to the interim constitution described it as providing a historic bridge between the past of a deeply divided society, characterized by strife, conflict, untold suffering, and injustice, and a future founded on the recognition of human rights, democracy, and peaceful coexistence and development opportunities for all South Africans, irrespective of color, race, class, belief, or sex. There are at least two parts of our commitment to change. The first is the pursuit of a truly, substantively equal society. We may unpack this as follows. It recognizes the moral entitlement of persons to what some call positive liberty. That is, the ability actually to exercise your rights and to pursue your chosen projects rather than a mere empty entitlement to do so. And it recognizes that this entitlement vests in everyone equally. We recognize that the government bears duties to refrain from taking steps that restrict people's ability equally to exercise their rights and freedoms. But equally importantly, we recognize that the government also bears duties to take positive steps to protect, promote, and fulfill the equal freedom of the people. Thus, South Africa's pursuit of substantive equality requires both state prevention of status-based discrimination and state promotion of distributive justice. This, in turn, means a radical commitment to the state provision of services to all and the leveling of the economic playing fields that were so drastically skewed by the apartheid system. It also means binding private persons to do their bit to pursue the constitutional dream. Two of the most important means to these ends are, in South Africa, affirmative action measures and the entrenchment of socio-economic rights. The second element of transformation that I wish to emphasize is a shift from a culture of paternalistic state authoritarianism to a culture of the ongoing and never-ending justification of state power. This means that it is no longer sufficient for judges to rely on the mere say-so of previous courts or parliament as justifications for their decisions. Instead, judges now bear the ultimate responsibility to justify their decisions, not only by reference to authority, but by reference to ideas and values. In addition, transformation is a permanent ideal. It envisions a society that will always be open to change, open to dialogue and contestation, and that is careful never to slip into a useless self-congratulatory complacency when it stops imagining that things could be better. To sum up, then, what I mean by South Africa's social contract of transformative constitutionalism is this. We as a society have agreed to commit ourselves to an ongoing project of improving our lives so that we are equally able, actually, to exercise our rights and freedoms. It's now time to shift our focus to socio-economic rights themselves. Before I explain and illustrate their concrete role in South Africa's project of transformative constitutionalism, a little more theoretical groundwork is necessary. Firstly, I should say that I agree with Professor Sandra Fredman that the traditional categorization of human rights must be abandoned. That approach, according to her, and I quote, draws a bright line around a cluster of concepts. Duties of restraint are attached to freedom protecting civil and political rights, while positive duties attach to equality promoting socio-economic rights. The former are justiciable, the latter are aspirational, unquote. To this caricature may be added the standard refrain that negative state duties are necessarily concrete. immediately enforceable and resource-free, while positive state duties are necessarily indeterminate, programmatic, and resource-intensive. Professor Fredman convincingly explains why this traditional picture is incorrect in some respects and over-exaggerative in others. There is no clear hierarchy between the two categories. Instead, they interact in important ways. Freedom of expression, for instance, or association is of little use to someone without food, water, and a home. Equally, freedom of expression and association are probably instrumental in preventing or ameliorating poverty. Moreover, civil and political rights cannot be distinguished from socioeconomic rights by reference to the duties they give rise to. The separate architecture of the ICCPR and ICESCR belies the simple fact that both categories of rights can give rise to both negative duties, to refrain from interfering with their exercise, and positive duties to protect and promote their exercise. This civil and political right to life may be interpreted to give rise to positive state duties to protect and promote life by providing emergency health care, food, and shelter. The civil and political right to a fair trial may be interpreted to give rise to a positive state duty to provide legal representation to indigent accused persons. Concomitantly, the socioeconomic right of access to housing obligates the state to refrain from unlawful evictions. The right of access to water imposes a duty on the state not to turn off the taps. This overlap has many implications. Most obviously, perhaps, it exposes as a fallacy the standard refrain that only socioeconomic rights have budgetary implications. For all positive duties have such implications. Nevertheless, although the positive duties arising from civil and political rights also impact on the budget, their enforcement is less likely to evoke the fierce legal controversy that the enforcement of socioeconomic rights does. Many would decry as a grave violation of human rights a government decision drastically to reduce public spending on the justice system, forcing the closure of police stations, legal aid schemes, and even some courts. This would be characterized as a breach of the positive duties arising from the rights to access to courts and a fair trial, among others. In contrast, the closure of state schools and hospitals, although similarly in breach of positive state duties, is unlikely in many quarters to be denounced as a violation of the human rights to education and emergency health care. I do not think such distinctions bear critical scrutiny. I believe that we should move away from the theoretical picture of civil and political rights as radically different to socioeconomic rights, and instead focus on the ways in which judicially enforced positive state duties may legitimately fulfill the promise of both categories of rights. This, I believe, is a theoretical area that remains ripe for discussion, despite the fact that socioeconomic rights have been the subject of debate for several decades. These are the relatively uncharted waters that the South African Constitutional Court has had to navigate with few companions since 1994. Having briefly discussed social contract theory and South Africa's project of constitutional transformation, and having touched on the nature of socioeconomic rights, I now turn to consider the practical experience of South African courts in this area. Bearing in mind the facts that the judiciary have neither the expertise nor the political accountability to determine the exact manner in which budgets should be spent, this has been a challenging task. Nevertheless, I believe that we have thus far been successful in beginning to develop a creative and meaningful socioeconomic rights jurisprudence, which acknowledges the institutional and political limitations of the judiciary, but also contributes to our transformative project by ensuring that socioeconomic rights are a reality, they have teeth. In particular, I would like to highlight how the themes of transformative constitutionalism, substantive equality, distributive justice, and the ongoing duty of justification, how these emerge in socioeconomic rights adjudication. The ultimate goal, of course, of social transformation is to reach a level of substantive equality, where everyone is able to lead a life consistent with human dignity. This is perhaps another way of expressing the ideal in which we are all equally, actually, able to exercise our rights and freedoms and to pursue our chosen projects. It is unsurprising, therefore, that equality and dignity are two founding values of our Constitution and our transformative project. Acknowledging and enforcing socioeconomic rights is an important means by which we hope to achieve these ideals of substantive equality and human dignity. I believe that where people are denied shelter, education, food, and other basic necessities, they are denied the right to live a dignified human existence on equal terms with their brothers and sisters. Given this transformative role of equality, I would like briefly to focus on the role of equality in our socioeconomic rights jurisprudence. The approach of our court has been to hold that a socioeconomic right has been violated when the benefit in question is provided in an unfairly discriminatory way. We have dealt, for instance, in a particular case with a government decision to exclude non-South African citizens from a social assistance program. The applicants argued that this was inconsistent with the state's duty to promote social security to everyone. The majority of the court held that the government's decision amounted to unfair discrimination, which in turn meant that the state failed to fulfill its duty to take reasonable measures to achieve the progressive realization of access to social security in terms of the relevant provisions of the Constitution. The court found for the applicants because the disputed policy infringed the rights of a group of vulnerable people who were excluded from a transformative economic and social policy. and deliver the judgment, the court delivered the judgment, which had notable budgetary implications. Similarly, in another case, which we call the Treatment Action Campaign case, relief was granted to another vulnerable group of people. These were pregnant women living with HIV who had been denied access to a resource which others were given. The government had provided antiretroviral drugs only at certain research and training sites for those living with HIV. This was not made available at other public hospitals and clinics. The court ordered the government to remove these restrictions on the availability of antiretroviral at public hospitals, thereby vindicating the rights of both healthcare services and equality. There are other cases which could serve as examples. But these cases, I believe, provide good examples of how judges may invoke the widely accepted prohibition on status-based discrimination as a legitimate and relatively uncontroversial tool in socioeconomic rights adjudication. If the state is going to provide socioeconomic benefits or impose a socioeconomic burden, it must do so in a non-discriminatory manner. We have seen how transformative constitutionalism is primarily concerned with distributive justice and the elimination of poverty by focusing on the needs of the underprivileged. We have also seen how it entails a shift away from a culture of unadulterated authority to a culture of justification. The need to justify government policy and its implementation has therefore greatly influenced our approach in enforcing socioeconomic rights. By adopting a standard of reasonableness in rights adjudication, our courts require state representatives to come to court and justify to the litigants and the public in general its preferred socioeconomic policies and programs. And where the reasons advanced in defense of the state's choices are insufficient, we may declare those choices to be unconstitutional. The question we ask ourselves is this: given our deeply important commitment to transformation, is this statute, this law, is this program or policy reasonable in the circumstances? This flexible approach is designed to avoid ruling on the adequacy of particular social policies where they constitute sincere and reasonable attempts fairly to allocate and apportion scarce resources. Wading in more deeply may very well be counterproductive, for judges do not have the necessary expertise and could otherwise make harmful decisions. Consequently, I do not think it wise judicial policy to recognize ossified and immediately enforceable socioeconomic entitlements for all individuals. Instead, we provide a forum within which ordinary people can demand that the state explain why its attempts to realize socioeconomic rights are reasonable. In another judgment by the Constitutional Court, which we refer to as Grootboom, we held that, for instance, the state programs were aimed at protecting a particularly vulnerable section of our society. In that case, the right to access to adequate housing was invoked by the applicants, who in desperation had no choice but to build wholly inadequate shelters on privately owned land. When the matter came to the Constitutional Court, the state had to provide reasons for this failing in its housing program. For reasons I shall discuss, we declared that the policy was unreasonable. We also explained some of the elements of the reasonableness standard in order to guide government in its reformulation of the relevant policy, but recognized that the ultimate responsibility for housing programs rests on government. This is an appropriate juncture to mention the relevance to socioeconomic rights of a final theme of transformation, namely the need for a society that will always be open to change, dialogue, and contestation. This is particularly relevant to socioeconomic rights because they are to be realized progressively. This means that what the state is obligated to do today may be different to what it is obligated to do tomorrow. We must ensure that socioeconomic entitlements and obligations do not ossify. There is a need for flexibility and a focus on context, which allows us continually to reassess what is required in particular circumstances, the hope being that over time, distributive injustices will subside and unfair discrimination will wane. It must be recognized, despite all that I have said, that widespread transformation of economic and social conditions is beyond the power of the courts alone. The central purpose of social rights and other rights is first and foremost to direct the state in its work to fulfill its constitutional mandate. To do this, the state needs assistance from other stakeholders. I believe that the role of the courts in this regard is to engage in what may be termed a constitutional conversation with government, guiding it as to how to fulfill its constitutional mandate. The courts should be seen to be working with the state in fulfilling socioeconomic rights, which would avoid creating the impression that they are attempting to usurp government's political role. Such perceptions may compromise the legitimacy of and confidence in the judiciary, or make state officials reluctant to obey court orders. It is not, however, only organs of state that need to take part in the realization of socioeconomic rights. Civic society and public interest groups, and even private persons, have an important part to play. I would like to conclude by briefly considering the relevance, if any, of South Africa's social contract of transformation to other nations, and in particular to the developed world. It is obvious that our constitutional project is closely tied to South Africa's divisive history of race-based segregation and disempowerment, and the massive inequalities that remain today. However, let me say this, and say it unequivocally, that I believe our experience is of direct relevance to others. It may be that South Africa is characterized by a greater degree of inequality of wealth, education, housing, and so forth, than, say, the United Kingdom. It may be that we therefore need to emphasize the themes of transformation and change more than other nations. However, the fact is that no nation has achieved the social ideal in which all people are equally able, actually, to exercise their rights and freedoms. No nation has achieved perfect distributive justice and substantive equality. And conditions within states, including distributions of burdens and benefits, may change over time. Therefore, it seems to me that every nation should consider deeply ways in which the plight of those without a say in the democratic process and with little bargaining power in concluding the social contract may be alleviated by sympathetic state intervention. That way, all nations should ponder the value of legally obliging the state to take positive steps to protect and fulfill socio-economic rights. I thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll have a few questions now, perhaps. Thank you. You're way in the back, and so you'll have to, in a very large room.
Okay, thank you for your talk. Chief Justice, I was wondering, would you be able to please speak to some of the challenges the South African judiciary is currently facing with regards to its independence as well as its impartiality and the mandate to carry out its activities without fear of failure?
Is there another question? Can I take another question at the same time?
And the question I'd like to ask you is, what advice would you give to courts in how they can improve their work in practice in trying to sort out these complex trade-offs that you do in the economic and social arena? I'm particularly thinking of the way our own courts, the Court of Appeal and the House of Lords, in trying to work out complex employment cases, finds it very difficult to sort out the economic arguments involved. I think one's noticed similar things in tribunals in France and on occasions in the European Court of Justice as well. And I just wondered if you have any suggestions of how judges could actually, if you like, raise their game, and indeed how people appearing before them could also raise their game in resolving these complex issues.
Okay, I think that's enough.
Okay.
Let me start with the last question. It's difficult, of course, to give advice to other courts. The first question relates to the independence of courts and of members of the judiciary, which is correct. They are independent, and I would not want to prescribe to United Kingdom courts how they should deal with the particular problems which they are facing. We, however, believe, or I believe, that much of the adjudication depends on the particular interpretation which the courts give to respective problems and issues which come before them. The only thing I would suggest is that the interpretation which judges should give is a progressive, enlightened judgment. I have suggested here in my talk that where you have unequal power relations, one should, in the position of a judge, rather lean towards an interpretation which favors the poor in terms of you don't bend the law, but you realize that you're dealing with unequal power relations. You're dealing with people who can't express themselves because they have no access to the means to express themselves. So you must give maximum sympathy to those people because they cannot afford what the other people can afford. Having said that, I should not enter the terrain of prescribing to other jurisdictions how they should deal with issues before them. We deal with socio-economic rights from the point of view of the disparities in our nation. You know that there are people who have no access to court simply because they have no access to education. You know that there are people who have no access to proper health care because they can't afford it. And so on and so forth. And people who may not have access to legal representations because they cannot afford it. So you deal with your socio-economic rights on that kind of foundation, recognizing the disparities in society. And I think there is something there for other courts, other jurisdictions also, to emulate that kind of procedure. Let me get to the first question. Challenges faced by South African judiciaries or courts in relation to independence and things like that. I think you are referring to a number of bills which were proposed by the Department of Justice in relation to the courts themselves, the bills which sought to make a distinction between judicial functions and administrative functions. You know that courts have got to be built, courts have got to be furnished, there's got to be stationary in the courts. In other words, they've got to be provided with resources. They've got to be provided with staff, which is non-judicial staff. Now, those bills impacted on those issues. But there was widespread discussion, and people spoke up. They said, if you destroy the distinction between judicial functions and administrative functions, you are actually impacting on the independence of the courts. There was quite a furore about it in South Africa. It was a discussion until the president decided that those bills should be put on ice. So speaking to you as I do now, those bills are on ice and people are looking at other ways of resolving what might potentially be a conflict. I would not say, therefore, that the independence of the judiciary in South Africa is threatened at this stage. But it does show what the value of other people, other than the courts themselves, what the value of freedom of speech, people speaking out and saying, we don't like this. It does show that this can be effective. The people in South Africa, a lot of them, actually spoke up against those. At the moment, it's on ice, so we don't know if it's ever going to be taken out of the freezer. But if it is, we will speak up again.